So, Mark, chapter 7. Again, Jesus called the crowd to him and said, "Listen to me, everyone, and understand this. Nothing outside a person can defile them by going into them. Rather, it is what comes out of a person that defiles them." After he had left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about this parable. "Are you so dull?" he asked. "Don't you see that nothing that enters a person from the outside can defile them? For it doesn't go into their heart, but into their stomach and then out of the body." In saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean. He went on to say, "What comes out of a person is what defiles them. For it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come: sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and defile a person." Chance for us to have a little break now. On that note, turn around and say good day.
In fact, my little fella, I usually bring someone with me when I come on Sundays. And Luca on the way here said, "Dad, this is 7 in a row." And I'm like, "What do you mean?" It's like, "Church, 7 days in a row." Because he's done Summerfest every day and we did church on Saturday night. And then here, and I'm like, "How are you feeling about that?" It's like, "It's awesome." You know? And I'm thinking, I genuinely very grateful to be part of a church where we're able to run kids' ministries that just help me disciple my kids and help them love church. It's phenomenal. And I'm not always going to expect that my kids are going to want to love things. Sometimes I'm going to need to drag them along. But gee, it's nice for them to celebrate that with us. Enjoy it while it's there, is that right? Yeah. Great. So it's good to be diving into this series that we're doing over the next 4 weeks, How Would You Fix the World? And particular welcome to you if you are here, particularly because you're interested in what we're doing during this series. I hope you find this helpful. And as Greg mentioned, we will have time for questions. I'll preach a little bit shorter than I normally do, so I'll bring it down to about 3 hours, right? And then fair bit shorter. And then so fire away your questions, and we'll see if I've got anything to say in regards to your questions. Now, with the Central Coast, I'm coming and going. Yeah. Is it me, boys? With this question that we asked the Central Coast, the first observation I would have is this, that people had no trouble understanding the question. Yeah, when we asked people, "How would you fix the world?" people offered their answers quite quickly, because apparently it's easy to notice that our world has some serious problems. Yeah? And I think you can see them close to home sometimes. It's really obvious when there's brokenness in your own family or in your own neighbourhood, in our own country. But over the last few weeks, it's pretty easy to notice that some pretty horrific things have been happening. Just the last few days, what's been happening in France, it's just horrifying. And we find ourselves shaking our heads and thinking, what's come of this world? What can we do to fix this world? It's got some serious problems. Now, there's different answers that people have offered, and we put together those top four answers. In fact, have you got that slide of the top four? No, that's okay. Over the next 4 weeks, we're going to be looking at different things, and the different suggestions or different solutions that people have offered to how you fix the world would suggest a different diagnosis of the problem that the world's got, right? So some people would say the big problem with this world is religions. We need to get rid of religions, or at least to get rid of extremism within religions. We're going to deal with that on week 3. And some people would say, no, the problem with this world is, you know, our authority structures, and we need to get a better form of governance. And there is an idea, and we're going to deal with that next week. This week, some people, I think, have given that really honest answer. No, the problem with this world is just the people in the world. And I think that's a really honest answer. That's one we're going to deal with today. But it is important, isn't it, to make a correct diagnosis of the problem? Because if you don't get the problem right, if you don't figure out what the problem really is, then you'll come up with a solution that won't work. Yeah. So a mate of mine recently, his father, I saw him during the week, had this scab wound on his hand for quite a while, and he thought it was just a scab wound kind of thing, and so he was just giving it plenty of air, plenty of sunlight, and then found out it was actually a melanoma, and it was growing and getting really bad. See, it really matters that you've get the correct diagnosis of what's going on, because now he's got a completely different approach to the issue. It matters that you figure out what's really happening. So what is really wrong with our world? Right at the core, what is it that causes all the problems? Well, some people would say it's the people. And if we can fix the people, then we'll be able to fix our world. But let me clarify, I think, what people mean when they've given us that answer. When people have said we need to fix people, what I think people have been saying in response there is to say we need to fix some people, not all people. We just need to fix certain people because certain people have gone bad. Now, Carlos just said that to me before I hopped up. He said the problem, I'm going to dub you in. He said, just my wife, that's the problem, all right? I mean, no, that's right, it's not Carlos. He said, I'm perfect, but there's other people I'm worried about. Now, all jokes aside, I actually do think that that is what a lot of people think, that there are certain people that have gone quite bad. There's a small percentage of people in our society that have been really messed up and they've been really broken and corrupted, and they're the ones that actually are the cause of the majority of the big issues that we see. And if we can fix them, we'll be able to make the world a better place, a safer place to live in. Now, that kind of thinking does carry with it, though, people saying, well, of course we all contribute a little bit. You know, we all make mistakes, and so we all do a little bit of wrong, but the real problems come from a few bad eggs that have turned and are causing all the real issues. Because most of us are generally good at heart. Most of us are kind of okay people. We occasionally make mistakes, but we're generally good. And that hashtag, I'll ride with you, that came out after the hostage situation in Sydney, when I first heard that, I thought that's a wonderful expression of solidarity and friendship and love. But did you notice the media grabbed hold of that hashtag and made a lot of it, and really was just to hold the banner of, well, look, can you see, really, most of us are really nice people. Most of us are really good and generous, and we want to care for each other. But there's just a couple of people who have gone bad. Yeah? Some people are so seriously corrupted, like the man who takes the hostages in Sydney, or like the mother who kills 8 children in her house in Cairns, or like the men and women at the moment in France, some of them still at large, who are just wreaking havoc. And so many deaths and carnage has been happening there. So if we follow that train of thinking, we do need to, what's happened for these people? What's happened for them? We need to figure that out. Now, behind the assumption, behind the belief system that says most of us are good, some have gone bad, is this belief, can I suggest, that all people are born good and innocent, but then we get corrupted to a certain extent by the world that we come to live in. That's kind of a pretty common belief these days. I'd say that's the secular humanist kind of belief about humanity. We're all born good and innocent, but then we get corrupted to a certain extent. We get corrupted by the environment or the circumstance or the experience of life. You know, you think about the child that gets born into a very dysfunctional family and gets very broken through that experience. Or the kid who grows up but finds himself being influenced with peers that really turn him bad. Or to a certain extent, we'd all acknowledge, well, media has an impact on the way we think and they corrupt our thinking. Or some people, it'll be substance abuse that really wrecks them. Or generally, people say, look, it's just the whole of society and culture that impact us and shape us. We start out good, but then we all get impacted, and some people get severely corrupted and broken by their experience of life. And that, I think, is a pretty common belief system that most people in our society hold. We start out good at heart, but then we get ruined by external factors that come in from outside of us and corrupt us as people. And if that's true, then the solution really is to work on those external factors. Work on the environment around us. Work on all the factors that can impact the person. Because we're good at heart when we start out, but then we actually get wrecked by the world we live in. That's a very common belief, I want to suggest. But just as I suggest that belief, I can't help but just personally react to it, so if I could just do that for a moment. Do we really start out good? Are we really born completely innocent and good? Now, some people might hold that view. I don't know how you can hold that view if you've ever had kids. I mean, am I right? Think with me for about this one for a little bit. Maybe if you've never had kids, you can think that way. But if you've ever had kids, you'll know that right from really early on, there's something about them that's just rotten, isn't there? Now, my kids, I'm assuming my kids are no worse than anyone else's, but let me just, some of you, you might remember back to when you had that first little newborn baby, and some of you have got newborn babies at the moment. I see people sometimes walking into church just kind of looking like the walking dead, you know, because they're thinking, I haven't slept for months. My baby won't stop crying. They've got that look on their face like, can you die from sleep deprivation? You know, it's really kind of killing them. And I remember that feeling, and you can just freak out. And we come up with all these reasons why our babies won't sleep and why our babies just keep crying and, you know, gassy or reflux or colic. What is colic? I don't know. I think we just make things up sometimes to explain why our babies are so bad or lactose intolerant. But yeah, perhaps the truth is that really they're just evil and they're just messing with us. And they're just trying to keep us up all night. I've got four kids, right? So I remember, it wasn't too long ago, I remember going through whole seasons where I felt like all four kids were like ganging up on us to try and keep us up all night long. It's like they were tag teaming us, yeah? It's like, I don't know how they do that, but it's like they sit down and have a conference, yeah, before bedtime, you know? Righto, I'll take from 12 through to 2. You take 2 to 4. You take 4 to 6. And they use this deep voice as they're talking to each other because they're devious. And then by sunrise, mum and dad will be so stressed out, we'll be able to get whatever we want for breakfast. You know, I feel like, wow, kids are crazy. Some of you guys remember the crawling baby stage or the kind of the couch surfing toddler stage where they can get into things. Yeah, I remember my kids doing this. They spot something they want to get into that you don't want them to touch. It's the stereo or things with buttons or the PowerPoint, yeah? And they're heading towards it and you say, no, don't touch. And they stop and they look up at you and then they reach out with their hand while they're looking at you and grab that thing anyway. And we tell ourselves, oh, they don't really understand. And the kids, they're going, yeah, you tell yourself that, Dad. I'm just going to keep touching everything I can. I'm just going to keep getting into things, you know? Man, born innocent? I'm not sure about that. I mean, I've said this before. I never had to teach my kids how to be selfish or how to be greedy or how to get angry. I never had to teach them how to. They figured that out all on their own. I think one of my kids, the first word that came out of its mouth was mine. I said, I'm thinking, is he saying mum? And he said, no, mine. It's like, that's mine. So I never had to teach my kids how to be selfish. Where does that come from? That's not society. It's something in kids, and you can see it from a very early age. So I just want to kind of put it out there. I'm not sure that we're born completely good and innocent. I'm pretty sure we're not. And I think if you reflect honestly about what it's like when you have kids, you can see it. If you're looking for it, you can see it. However, let's just run with the line that we are born innocent for a little bit. Let's kind of live with that delusion for a little bit and think into the situation. If that was true, if it was true that we're born innocent and we get corrupted by our environment, external factors, family, friends, things that can happen, experiences, then really the solution would be to just to address all those external factors, wouldn't they? Just trying to fix all them up. So you see broken families and you think, okay, well, we need better support services. That's going to fix that. Or you see ignorance in young people and you think, well, we need better education. We need to inspire kids to make a difference with their lives. You see violence in people or in younger people and you think we need better censorship laws because they're obviously being impacted by what they're watching. Or you just see general bad behaviour in the next generation coming up, a disrespect, and you think we need to instill some ethics and some values and some morals in these people because they're not getting it. And that's usually where the Christian thing can kind of come in. People will say, well, we need to get some Christian values and morals into these people, into these next generation. And I see parents panic, you know, when they're raising their kids. And despite their best efforts to raise their kids to be really wonderful little human beings, they get quite shocked when their kids turn out to be quite selfish and angry and disrespectful. And sometimes parents will kind of panic a little bit and say, well, I'm just going to have to send my kid to church, you know, so they can get a bit of morals. You know, I don't want them to get all super religious and anything, but I just want them to get a bit straightened out. And a lot of people will get involved in church for that reason. I don't care what reason people get involved in church. It's going to be a good thing. But is that what Christianity is all about? Simply making people a little bit more moral. Now, just on this, it is a bit of a widespread view, I do think, that people view Jesus that way and Christianity that way. That Jesus came primarily as the great moral example. That's a pretty commonly held view. He's a really great guy, lived a very great life, and he came to kind of show us how to live that kind of life. Because, and behind that is the belief that really, because what people need, all we really need, is to be shown the way, to be led the way. We just need a good example, and then we'll know how to live well. So people hold Jesus up to be the great moral. Now, he certainly was a great moral example, but is that all he was? Was that the main reason why he came? Just to kind of show us how we should be living? Because we've got the ability to do it, we just need someone to show us. Well, if that was true, you would expect Jesus to be simply saying right throughout his ministry things like, look, just watch me, live like me, follow me, do what I do, and you'll be fine. Problem is, you never get Jesus saying that. Well, certainly, he comes close to saying things like that, but that's certainly not all he says. He says a lot more and a lot deeper things. You may even be quite surprised to hear what Jesus actually says. Because you'll come to see that he doesn't simply say, copy me and live like me. It's clear in Jesus' mind that he doesn't think the solution for us, for people, is that we just need a good example. We just need to kind of address the externals of life. Now, when Jesus looks at the problem in people and the problem in humanity, he diagnoses the problem in a far more serious way than many of us might. And it may be for some of you that you hear that the problem is far deeper than you ever expected when you hear the way Jesus diagnoses the problem. So let's do that. Let's go to that passage that we had read earlier, Mark chapter 7, where you've got Jesus speaking to a bunch of people, and he's speaking to them about life and fundamentally really what it takes to get fixed. And we hear in looking at this the way Jesus diagnoses the problem with humanity. Now, context here, if you're new to these things, the context we're looking at here, this is a situation, an event where Jesus is speaking to people 2,000 years ago. And you might think, well, what's that got to do with 2015? 15, wow, there we go. What's that got to do with this day and age? Well, the amazing thing is that this is so incredibly relevant for us, because what we've got here is we've got people 2,000 years ago, different context, but acknowledging the very same thing that we're talking about here today, and that is humanity's broken, people are broken, they need to be fixed. And what they're doing is they're attempting to fix people through working on the external things that actually come in and corrupt a person. That's their framework. You fix a person or you stay good by making sure the bad things stay out of you. That's their thinking. And so that is incredibly relevant, because that is almost the identical way that people today think as well. We're good at heart. You've got to keep the corruption out of you. Now, the context is also a religious context. So you've got, you know, religious folk trying to get fixed or stay good. And they're doing it by making sure they do ceremonial washing of their hands and ceremonial washing of eating implements. And they're doing that, so it's concerning food. They're doing that because they want to avoid any unclean food or bad food or corrupted food coming into them and corrupting them. So that's the way they're thinking, yeah? Now, you might think, well, for some of us, this is a strange context. Like, not many of us have been exposed to ceremonial washing food laws or anything like that. So in some sense, it's strange, but it's the exact same idea as what we're considering here today. The idea that most people think the problem is outside of them, and you need to protect yourself from being corrupted by things external to you. And so the solution is working on those things that are outside of you, making sure they don't come in and that you have protection from them. And effectively what Jesus does here, I'll tell you right up front, what he effectively says is, now you've got it the wrong way round. The problem is not in the externals, like the ultimate problem, not in the externals, but in the internals. And so the solution is not outside in, the solution is actually inside out. And the problem is not just for some. The problem is not just certain folks. The problem is for all. So it's pretty huge what Jesus says. Let's have a look. Verse 14 there. Again, Jesus called the crowd to him and said, listen to me, everyone, and understand this. So he's, when Jesus says that, he's really keen for everyone to hear what he's got to say. This is very important. People are not getting it. They really need to get it. So listen up, he says. Nothing outside a person can defile them by going into them. Rather, it is what comes out of a person that defiles them. The concept of being defiled is to be corrupted, you know, to be broken. And Jesus is saying, look, it's not about what's outside a person that comes in and gets, that's not how you get corrupted. That's not how you ultimately get broken. It's from things outside of you coming in. Corruption, Jesus says, originates within a person and actually comes out of you. Now, that's a bit of a shock to hear. It's not the kind of thing we want to hear. Verse 17. After that, he left the crowd. So he's speaking to a crowd in that context. He enters the house and his disciples ask him about this parable. So even Jesus' closest friends, closest followers didn't get this. And when they come inside the house, they say, now, what is with this thing you've just said? We don't get it. And Jesus, you know, responds to them in a way that only a close friend could. Verse 18, are you so dull? You know, like, guys, are you really that stupid? That's what Jesus says to his mates. Yeah, close enough to be able to say that. You really got to get this. Don't get this the wrong way around, otherwise you'll miss the whole point of me coming, Jesus says. Yeah? Are you so dull? He says, don't you see that nothing that enters a person from the outside can defile them? He just says it again. It's not about things out there coming into you that corrupt you and break you. And here's why, verse 19, for it does not go into their heart, but into their stomach and then out of their body. He's talking particularly about food here, and he's saying, this food that you consider to be bad, all it does is come in and go into your stomach and then you pass it out again. Lovely little illustration of how food works. Thank you, Jesus. It's good to know that. He says, the reason why bad food or really anything on the external can't corrupt you and break you is actually because it doesn't go into your heart. So the heart is the very center of the issue here. It's about your heart and the condition of your heart. And Jesus is saying, it's not about things out there coming in and corrupting your heart. Now let's talk about heart for a minute. Because whenever Jesus talks about the heart or the Bible talks about the heart, if you're new to these things, he's not talking about the physical organ in your chest that pumps blood around your body. When the Bible talks about the heart, it's talking about effectively the spiritual heart of a person, the very soul of your being, the center of your personhood, the core of your being, the you in you, yeah? The place from which your will and your desires and your longings and your emotions and your beliefs come from. Effectively, we all live from our hearts, the very center of who you are. And Jesus has got some devastating news for us about our hearts, the very core of our being. He says, things outside of you don't corrupt that. It's corrupted already. And there's evidence of that in the way you live and what comes out of you. Look at verse 20. We'll go on to the next one. He went on. What comes out of a person is what defiles them. In other words, what comes out of your heart actually shows that you are defiled. And Jesus is saying really clearly, it's what's in here, in the internal. It's its condition that actually corrupts you. It's not coming in from outside of you. Jesus says the problem is in here already. And that is devastating news. It's a devastating thing to consider. The problem's already in here. The Bible talks about the heart in this kind of way, in this kind of devastating way a number of times. One of the famous ones is Jeremiah chapter 17. It says, the heart is deceitful above all things. Your heart. The heart is deceitful above all things. It is beyond cure. Who can understand it? Now, it's not nice things to hear about your own center of your being, but the Bible would continually affirm that about the heart. And Jesus goes on to make it very explicit there. Look at verse 21. For it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come. We'd love to think that bad things come out of us because of the way we've been influenced. But Jesus says, no, it just comes out of your heart. Sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and defile a person. It's a pretty huge thing to consider. That's hard to swallow. It's far easier to think that really it's the external factors around me that have corrupted me. It's far easier for me to think when I do have an evil thought, I think like that because the people around me are evil and they've taught me to think like that. I've been listening to evil people for too long, you know? But the truth is, no, even without any evil people around me being exposed to any of that, no, my heart will come up with evil thoughts all on its own. It's that broken. Sexual immorality. You know, you might notice some sexual brokenness and immorality in yourself or in others. And the easiest thing to do is to say, well, look, our society is just sexually debauched. And the exposure that people have to pornography these days just means our view on sex and our approach towards it is so broken. But friends, what Jesus is telling us here is that even if you'd never been exposed to anything unhelpful about sexuality, even if you'd never been exposed to pornography or anything lewd, your heart would all on its own come up with sexually immoral thoughts and behaviours to do. Jesus says, yeah, the problem's here. That's hard to hear. Murder. You know, Jesus says, you know, hating people is just like that. And again, you might notice in yourself, sometimes you hate people or you feel racist towards others or classist towards others or other people do. And it's an easy thing to think, oh, look, that's just the way I was bred. You know, I got brought up in a family that kind of taught me to hate others, especially those people and these people. So that's why I think like that. No, even if you'd never had, you know, any of that kind of exposure upon you, your heart would hate people and others all on its own because it's broken and corrupted. That would just come out of you. Slander. Sometimes we'll find ourselves just slandering others, using foul language to speak about others or at least thinking it in our minds. And again, it's far easier to think, oh, look, I slander others just because I'm so used to, you know, hearing other people speak badly of others. Sometimes it just comes out. Or I've been exposed to so much foul language, sometimes it just slips out of my mouth. Even if you'd never heard anyone else slander, even if you'd never heard a swear word from someone else, your heart would come up with its own swear words. You'd invent your own and you'd be slandering others. That's what Jesus is saying here. Evil things actually come from your heart. They originate from here. It's your own heart that corrupts you. The problem is me. The problem is in you. Jesus' diagnosis of the problem with people is that the core of your very being is corrupted. That's pretty full on. That's pretty full on. And if that's true, I'm not sure whether you really believe that to be true or not. It's pretty clear what Jesus is saying there. If it's true, what's the solution then? What can a person do about their heart? What can you do about the very core of your being? Well, you could try to train it. You could try to coach it. You could try to encourage it. You could try to contain its evil, you know, minimize the harm that might come from your heart. But the truth is, you'll never heal your own heart. You'll never fix completely the very core of your own being. What you need is a new one. You need a new heart. You need effectively a heart transplant, a spiritual heart transplant. And the good news is, that is exactly what God offers us. He offers us new hearts, a new center of your being, which is the incredible news about Christianity. Yeah? God makes a beautiful promise about 1,000 years before Jesus even came, a promise about an offer of a new heart. You get in Ezekiel chapter 36, and many of you have probably read this before, but can we grab Ezekiel 36? There it is. Look at the promise that comes. I'll give you a new heart. Look at that. I'll give you a new heart. I'll put a new spirit in you. I'll remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. There's the promise of God. An acknowledgement of a heart of stone that already exists. Stone that's hard towards God, hard towards others. It's got all kinds of evils that have come out of it. And God says, I'll give you a new one. I'll give you a transplant. And the transplant's going to come, really. You get a new heart as God's spirit enters into you. And you have him by his spirit living in you, and there's your new heart. And as God's spirit comes to live in you, he says, "And I'll put my spirit in you, and I will move you to follow my decrees." So God says, as I come to live in you by my spirit, as I come to actually give you a brand new heart, I'm going to move you from the inside. I'm going to change your desires. I'm going to change your thinking. I'm going to change you from the inside. I'm going to transform you from the inside out. And that's how I'm going to bring new life in you, from the inside out. That's pretty radical. It's so good to hear that a new heart is on offer. And friends, this new heart actually is offered clearly to all of humanity with the coming of Jesus. Because when Jesus comes, lives a life on our behalf, a perfect life, dies a death in our place, and then rises again from the dead, he turns to humanity and he goes, I'm going to offer you a new heart now. And all you need to do is put your trust, your belief, your faith in what I've done for you, the life I've lived for you, the penalty of your brokenness that I've taken for you. Trust in that, believe in that, and you can have a new heart. Like, I will come and live in you by my Spirit, and I'll actually give you the transformation that you desperately need, the transformation that is from the inside out. A heart transplant, a spiritual heart transplant. I'm going to give you whole new desires. Now, just on the outset, to hear this kind of news that comes to us through the Christian scriptures tells us that we have a God who loves his creation. He loves humanity. He loves us enough that he actually grieves very deeply over our brokenness and the corruption of humanity. You know, sometimes we think we struggle to deal with the evil around us and struggle to reflect on how broken our world is. God struggles more. He grieves more the brokenness in humanity. He grieves it so much that he determines to fix it. And being all powerful, he can and he does through sending Jesus, our Saviour, who comes to offer us the thing we desperately needed, which is a new heart. He sends Jesus as a spiritual cardiologist, if you want, you know, to offer us a heart transplant we really need and deal with the major issue. You see, if the major issue was something else, if it wasn't to do with the heart, if it was something else outside of us and God wanted to fix it, then like if it was just general ignorance in society and God wanted to fix that, he would have sent a educator. Yeah? Jesus would have just been an educator. If the major issue was something else, like among humanity, just a lack of inspiration or motivation or vision, then God would have sent a life coach to inspire us and lead us. If the problem in humanity was simply poor health or disease, God would have sent a doctor to fix it. If the problem with all of humanity was finances, unequal distribution, then God would have sent an economist, which would have been very boring. You know, if the problem with humanity was just bad behavior, just generally bad behavior, then God would have just sent a great moral example or a disciplinarian to just get us all into shape, straighten us all out. But none of those things are the major problem. They're part of the problem, but they're not the core of the problem. The big issue is a broken heart, a corrupted heart, the very core of our beings, rebellious and corrupted. And so God sends a Saviour to give us new hearts. Let me finish with this quote, which I've tweaked a little bit to make it my own. In regards to addressing external factors, social reform and personal improvement, like addressing external factors, will put a new suit on the man. Jesus comes to put a new man in the suit. You got it? He comes to fix the person. That's incredible news. Well, there you go. I'm going to pause there now because I've gone for long enough, I think. And that may have, you know, brought up some questions. And now's the time to fire away and we can kind of knock that around for a little bit. Go for it.
Okay, so there's a lot of people who obviously don't believe in Jesus, who don't believe in God,
yeah,
and that sort of thing, who then have problems, overcome them, you know, deal with obviously some of the issues of the heart without maybe necessarily getting to the core.
Yeah.
As you know, you'd see them as a really positive contribution,
yeah,
to some of these fixing issues.
Mm.
How do you sort of respond to that in terms of, you know, like you can look at, oh, I can't think of someone, you know, even Mother Teresa, or
good.
I mean? You've got lots of people who are,
yep,
amazing without necessarily,
yeah,
dealing with those.
That's great. Did everyone hear that comment, question? And so let me validate that. And please don't hear me writing that off. There are there are multiple different efforts that many people can be involved in which do improve life for people, absolutely, and protect people. And it is wonderful to be involved in those things. And those things will bring a certain level of improvement and a certain level of help and hope for people. And so I want to validate that, and I want to say, it is important that we all are concerned for education and medicine and psychological health of people and social reform. We are to be concerned about all those things, but understanding that ultimate hope, the ultimate solution, is actually not found in any of those things, because the problem's far deeper than simply those things. So let me validate and say, yes, great things can happen through giving yourself to a whole bunch of different social action. And we need to be involved in doing what we can. And in fact, Christians are the ones who have led the way in most cultures in developing a whole range of those social factors to help with the experience of life. But we do that holding to the very key thing, which is the healing of the heart that needs to happen ultimately for a person. Jesus says, you know, you can... a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions, meaning, you know, you can gather possessions to yourself, you can gather health to yourself, you can gather, popularity to yourself, you can do wonderful things for yourself, but ultimately your life does not consist in the success of an array of a whole bunch of social things, you know. You've got to have your heart healed. So yeah, they're good, they're valid, but they're not ultimate. Jesus points us to the ultimate thing that we must deal with, which is to have our hearts healed, yeah? And, yeah.
And isn't it also that this is what God's love and His grace is all about?
Mm.
That He actually uses these things for society. I mean, if you were to take all this away, I mean, our world would be so much worse off.
Mm.
And they would be so miserable.
Yeah.
I mean, we couldn't exist.
Yep. Yeah. It does. That's good, Ruth. And I want to I think for as Christians to believe what Jesus is on about is to make sure we're always got real sharp eyes on the big thing. So the sharp point, the ultimate focus of Jesus's God's grace towards us and love towards us is what He does with Christ on the cross to heal our hearts. That is the epicenter of God's grace towards us. However, there's an onflow of God's grace through all different elements of life, which are wonderful, but as Christians, we've got to keep going, yeah, we need to be involved in all of that and understand all that is helpful, but keep coming back to the ultimate point of God's grace. It has been the peril of the church throughout the ages that Christians will drift towards all the other, I would say, minor expressions of God's grace. That might be a little bit harsh to call them minor expressions, but they are God's grace in all areas of life, and left behind the ultimate area of God's grace, which is to see people's hearts forgiven. So yes, let's keep focused on that, but understanding God's grace goes on from that. Great. That's a great question, isn't it? So your experience as a Christian of being someone who believes you've received a new heart? Okay. Yeah, that's good. And I would say that it is a common experience for Christians to receive a new heart and then just be surprised at the amount of evil that still comes out of you. You might not use that word, but that's what it is. And to be depressed by the lack of forward movement that you thought there would be. Let me just say two things. Number one, it is the case that sometimes God brings radical transformation at the moment of conversion. Yeah, I met with a friend's dad recently, the guy with the melanoma in his hand. And he became a Christian about 35 years ago. He was a drunk, wife beater, smoker, gambler, you name it. He was everything. And he had this really radical conversion where he just, for some reason, walked into a church, sat down, heard about Jesus, became a Christian. And he said in that moment, he was transformed. Like radical kind of healing from all kinds of addictions. And I said, so he said, mate, for 35 years, I've been a new man, which is so good to see, you know, 35 years down the track, because some people will claim to be instantaneously changed, but then a few years down the track, they've gone back to it. But I said to him, so are you telling me you really haven't felt temptation to go back to any of those things over the years? He said, no, a lot of the temptation has just been completely removed from me, healed of it. And he's been loving his wife and serving his kids and running AA meetings and doing a whole bunch of things for many years, and he's never missed a week at church, all that kind of stuff. And he's got joy in his heart. He's 86 or something like that now. And so sometimes for some people, at the moment of conversion, there can be miraculous transformation where the new heart is just so evident, instantaneously evident. I want to say that's almost the unusual case. What we see for most people is gradual transformation, gradual change over time, as God intends to change us. It's very clear God intends to change us. He doesn't move in and live in us by his Spirit and then leave us the way we are. He says, no, you're a work in progress, and I'm going to change you. I'm going to conform you in the likeness of my Son. Now, sometimes it's hard to see the change, and it'd be easy to think, oh, I don't know if there's been much change. But it is worth looking back 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. And if you seriously cannot notice any change, no change, then I think that might be cause for thinking, all right, well, I need to review this. Have I really put my trust in him? Has he really entered me by his Spirit? That's worth wrestling with. Have I really put my faith in Jesus? Because if he does live in me by his Spirit, we can expect there to be change. It may not be as fast as we'd like or as radical as we desire, but there will be change. Sometimes a few steps forward, a couple steps back, but over time there will be change. And we hang in there, though there may not be the change at the pace we like, because we know we're heading towards a moment where we will be finally completely healed of sin. You see, when we become Christians and we get new hearts, the presence of sin still hangs around in our life. You're still in a body that's a broken body. Let me just describe it like this. You become a Christian and the presence of sin is still there. The power of sin is not. You're no longer a slave to sin. You no longer sit under the penalty of your sin, but the presence of sin will still remain in your life, and there will be a battle for you to pursue the new nature. You heard Kate talk about it. She said sometimes in that video, she said, sometimes I feel like going back to my old nature and I need to keep pursuing the new. There's a battle. We hear about that in Galatians and a number of Paul's letters where we need to, you know, be renewed in the Spirit, not in the flesh. So there's going to be a battle, but we're going to wrestle with the presence of sin in our life until we come to glory. So there's kind of a long-winded, waffly answer, yeah? Yes.
If the problem is from within and we need God to give us a new heart, then why is it that God hasn't given a new heart to everyone in the world?
Yeah. So why hasn't God given a new heart to everyone in the world? Now, perhaps I'll say that slightly differently. Why hasn't God imposed a new heart on everyone in the world? I don't think God is the one who imposes. God is the one who sovereignly comes to us and draws us to himself, but he does that whilst leaving intact a person's will and genuine responsibility to put their trust in him. Yeah? This is one of the things that blow our mind about God and his sovereignty. He leaves our will intact and he calls us to come and trust in him. So the ones who receive new hearts are the ones who, in their own responsibility, decide to trust and believe in him, and he calls us to come and do that. And he says, all those who come and put their trust in me, I'll give you a new heart. Yep. And he does that whilst remaining sovereign. So, yeah. Yep.
I assume when you said that we still are under not the power of sin, the influence of sin, then I assume you're saying that we still sin.
That we still sin?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, if this is so, why do we put so much emphasis in Romans 7 about Paul saying that the good I want to do, I don't do it, and the one I don't want to do, I do? That he's talking about what he was not saved. Why don't we accept that he's talking about his present life? That he's struggling. Because I feel that we sometimes put a lot of emphasis when we talk about Romans 7, that the assumption was he was talking that this was before he was saved.
Yeah, good, good. So the question about how you read Romans 7 is a slightly different one. And we did deal with that here in church when we went through Romans. I certainly think we need to acknowledge the challenge of the presence of sin, and we get that in many other passages, which I think are far more explicit about that. So you go to Galatians 5 and you hear about the struggle. And so there's a lot of other passages that are just really explicitly talking about the present struggle for the Christian. I'm still pretty convinced Romans 7 is Paul reflecting on his pre-Christian existence, but that's an ongoing debate about Romans 7 that we can keep having. Yeah. But certainly you don't want to do that at the expense of saying, hey, the Christian life is very, the struggle is very real. Yeah? Yes?
If people have had a heart since the beginning of time,
yeah,
and the only solution for a new heart is Jesus, why would God wait? Why would God send Jesus right at the very beginning? Why would he wait and have laws and people for him for that not to work?
Yeah, good, good, good. Which is a bigger question, is why does God do things the way he does things? Because what you get is this progressively unfolding revelation of God's solution for the world throughout the Bible. On some level, why does God do what he does? Well, he just does it because that's what he intends to do. I don't know. On other levels, you can actually see very clearly that even prior to Jesus, people are able to get those new hearts. Yeah, because you've got people being saved by faith. Abraham, they're putting their faith in a God who saves without even knowing really how it's going to happen through Jesus. But prior to Jesus, people get saved by faith in the very same way. Why does God take his time? Well, there's probably a few passages that would give us indication. Why does God do things the way he does it? God's patient, letting there be plenty of time. Let me open that up. Why do you reckon God does things the way he does things throughout over thousands of years through history? Pulling a
look at the Old Testament, so it's not even meant to try to understand. We think differently to God, and you know, you just got to accept the fact that he's God. You know, and one day, if he wants to, he'll tell you exactly why. But until such time, it's not your duty as a servant of God.
On one level, yes. Yep. Yes.
On another level, though, it does. That history, those laws, those things establish that we cannot achieve it by ourselves.
Yeah.
It establishes what Mark, you know, was saying, that, you know, that the evil comes from within. That, you know, no matter what we do on the outside, what we put into us can't make us unclean, but what comes out of us.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, it points to the real need. Yep. Good, Matt.
What's the passage where it says that God subjected the world to frustration?
Yeah, Romans 8.
That's sort of tying into the Pharisee as well. That was part of God's plan.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, we can
understand
that.
Yeah.
He subjected the world to frustration, so that we might learn something from that.
Yeah. That's good. I'll add one more thing if I can. Yeah. Yeah.
To save the world. And say we killed them because of our heart.
Yeah.
Until the moment that he sent Christ. So the plan of salvation was from the beginning anyway.
Let me add one thing which I think I hope might bring a little clarity. There's a level to which this is one of those questions that there's elements of it we can't answer. So great question. I would say this. What do you learn about a God who says he's going to do something and then over a period of 1,000 years ends up bringing it to fulfillment? You learn that he's a God of his word. He's a God who keeps his promises. He's a God who, even when you can't see it, you live by faith, not sight. And I do think that actually teaches us one of the very core things about the nature of the Christian life, which is faith, not sight. So if God says he's going to do something, even if he hasn't done it yet, and that's certainly the case for Moses, didn't get to enter the promised land, but trusted it was going to happen, Abraham, and all the prophets and all the key people throughout history, they're the ones, you know, you got Hebrews 11, Hall of Fame of the faithful, and they're all the ones who figured out, okay, this is a life by faith, not sight. I can't see it, I don't experience it, I'm going to trust that God knows what he's doing. That's certainly what we see through history, a God of who keeps his word. So I'll throw that one in there. Yeah. Have we... We'll probably stop there. Yeah, Greg's giving me the nod. All right. How about I pray and then we'll sing and we'll let me pray. Father, we thank you for your incredible goodness to us in life, particularly your goodness to us in Christ. Lord, we feel the state of our own brokenness, the state of the world's brokenness around us. We're so glad to hear that you grieve even more than we do about its brokenness, and love it enough to determine to fix it. Thank you for sending Jesus with an offer of a new heart, the very thing we needed to fix our major problem. Lord, I pray that we would be, and many others would be, those who have our trust and our faith soundly in you to receive your spirit and a brand new heart and actually see you do that work of change in us on our way towards the moment where we enter glory and are finally released from any presence of sin in us and in those around us. Lord, we thank you for your goodness. Amen.